You are listening to Prometheus by Minute. I'm your host, Connor Coulson. This is Minute 47. This minute opens with Shaw in the med lab saying, "David," and ends with David removing the helmet, revealing the engineer head within. And this week, I am joined by my very rare guest, Philip, from The Matrix Minute.
Hello, I am Philip from The Matrix Minute. I'm very happy to be here. Thanks, Connor, for inviting me.
Yeah, I had so much fun on The Matrix Minute, so I, you know, really wanted us to recapture that fun.
Let's hope so, but, you know, I was part of a trio there, and you just got me now, and it's just me. So I might, yeah, it might be two-thirds more fun,
yeah,
but it's going to be two-thirds less fun, so.
We shall see.
We'll see. I'll try my best.
So Prometheus, it's a controversial film. So I would like to get into your response and maybe how you felt about the fan response and all of that. So when did you first see Prometheus?
Oh, man. Okay. So here we go. Let's go all the way back and talk about Alien for a bit. Because, of course, this definitely has a huge interconnected connection to Alien, the original 1979 film. That was in 2004. Like, I knew about Alien for a very, very long time as a kid, but I was very, very scared to watch it because I heard from many people that it was the scariest movie ever made. And I'm not too...
Yeah, it's definitely a movie that has a reputation that precedes
yeah.
it. I definitely felt the same way of... That and The Exorcist and The Thing and Jacob's Ladder were the ones that people just went, nah, man.
Yeah.
Too much for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, so like some people even said, I mean, I didn't see the film yet. I don't know when I will ever see it, but The Exorcist was, you know, touted as being the scariest movie ever made. But I saw a bunch of reviews for Alien and they're like, Exorcist? Ha! No. Alien. Alien's scarier. Much scarier. And so I was like, I was intrigued by the sci-fi aspects, but I was terrified of watching it. But to make a story short, I finally did rent a DVD of Alien in 2004 because I was, you know, I watched all the Predator films and, I mean, Predator scarred me as a child because I watched it when I was 10, but I still loved it, which is interesting.
Weirdly, I'd seen Predator, but it wasn't the films that creeped me out. It was, I think it was a Sega Predator 2 game.
Really?
And there was something about I saw my dad playing. I'd never actually, I don't think I was allowed to play it myself. That game, something about the music. Yeah, I've got these really vivid memories. So you saw Alien around 2004. Did you see the AVP movies, which came out around the same time?
Well, that's the thing. This was early 2004, and I think we already were familiar with the... I don't even think we were familiar with AVP, the game. I think you know those computer games for Predator. Needless to say, we have to get to Prometheus, and here we are still talking about Alien.
No, we're going to go through every single Alien film one by one.
Well, I mean, we got three episodes, so I mean, yeah. I could, but needless to say, I watched Alien on DVD in early 2004. I was very afraid of what I will witness because of all the warnings that I got. Honestly, I wasn't that scared. I actually rather enjoyed the film and I was mesmerized by the visuals. And to be honest, now Alien is one of my favorite movies ever. And I could watch that anytime because of how the mood is and like the pacing of the film and the visual language and how the tone that it creates. It's my aesthetic and it just makes me feel great and it's spooky, but it's that kind of fear of the unknown spookiness that I really like a lot.
I think that you really captured what it is about that film quite well in terms of it is strangely a comfortable movie to watch. There's something about it. It's very ambient. It has this beautiful, it's not fast paced, but it's just moves along in a flow.
Yeah.
Everyone I know who likes Alien says one of the greatest qualities about it is that it's infinitely rewatchable.
It is. For some reason, it just totally is. It looks so good.
Yeah, it's an experience. It doesn't even feel like a movie.
It definitely is. Yeah, I totally could watch it anytime. If you're like, hey, let's watch Alien. I'm like,
yeah, let's watch it right now.
Okay.
Fuck the podcast.
Yeah. Forget this. We can watch the director's cut and the theatrical and we just keep looping. So then I watched Aliens and then Alien 3 and then Alien 4 and I didn't like Alien 4 very much. But then AVP and I liked it at the beginning, but then I realized the mistake I made about liking AVP. And then AVP 2 came out and I didn't even bother watching that. But then I watched it on DVD at some point and it wasn't very good. So moving on to Prometheus, I heard the rumors. I heard that Ridley Scott was coming back and I know that James Cameron and Ridley Scott were going to make some kind of Alien 5 thing sometime in like the mid-2000s or something. I'm sure you know about that. But Prometheus, okay, so I love the title. I was already hyped for that. I felt excited because this was going to be, as they said, not a direct prequel, I think. I think it used to be a direct prequel, but then it changed into something else.
Yeah, and in a later minute, we'll get into the scripts a little bit, but originally had Jonathan Spates wrote the initial script called Alien Engineers. So they're very much wanting to make it a prequel, and they knew this was going to be about the space jockey. That was a huge focal point of that script. And then a few years later, they bring in Damon Lindelof, and they want it to be less connected to Alien. I'm not really sure why that was. Maybe they just didn't want to alienate an unfamiliar audience. And then you end up with something that's a little less focused, let's just say.
Yeah.
I mean, there are still a lot of elements transferred from one script to the other. Some things were added, some things were taken out. And my belief is that if you put them together, you've got a perfect film.
Mm-hmm. But the film didn't do that, did it?
No, it has its issues, and I think that's what the show is all about, is as much as I love it, and it does have a rewatchable quality, and it's visually stunning, I keep coming back to why certain decisions were made, and I think what that is may have come from having read those two scripts. And there's a lot of behind-the-scenes content as well. So I'm constantly aware of, oh, they were going to do this, or they could do that.
Ah, well, it's good that you invited me because I have very, very similar opinions.
Oh, that's good.
Because I didn't read the scripts, though. I mean, maybe I should. Maybe that would be fun.
It's fun, but that's a lot of homework for a Movies by Minute podcast, I think.
True, but I think after we record this, I'm going to go read them. I'm probably going to read those then. But needless to say, I say that a lot in this episode. The time came where I was very excited for Prometheus. I was very interested because I knew that it would go back into the beginning. Just like the script says, Alien Engineers. It sounds like a Mattel toy line. Alien Engineers!
It does. And I would have bought them.
Me too. I already had ideas, like preconceptions of what I might see in the film. Particularly because of the engineer characters themselves, because I know that was going to be a big thing. I know many people were very, very hyped before the film came out, like the couple of weeks before.
There really was a lot of hype surrounding it.
Yeah.
And a lot of mystery, because I think the trailers didn't show much. They got these beautiful, sort of creepy, mysterious posters.
Oh, and it used the alien, the trailer sound.
It is not a nice sound, but it's so effective in those trailers. So the marketing was very strong.
Yeah. I loved it when I watched the trailers on the DVD, the alien that always stuck with me, especially the guy going, Alien Radar.
I miss the dubs that they do over trailers. It's fun to go back to even movies like 10 years ago. Adam is a little strange. He has autism and he meets Beth. and she's just moved in next door, and like explaining all that stuff. Like as if we've never seen a movie.
Yeah, little do they know, it'll change his life forever.
Yeah, bring that back, please. I know it's cheesy as hell.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
It's so much better than the boom, boom.
Oh, the bombs. I think the bombs are done. I think we've moved on to like that. So that's the new one.
Or sad versions of upbeat songs, like.
Oh, I hate that. Yes, I was. Thank you for reminding me. Okay, so then I watched it, and it was. I think this was the last movie I saw in film, 35mm film. So this was a late screening sometime near the end of its theatrical run in a cinema in Croatia where they still had one or two film projectors because they were converting to digital. I find it funny, like I'm going into a segue now, I'm sorry, but I happen to be a huge proponent of digital. I love digital filmmaking. I love digital recording. It's convenient. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. But if you're not careful, it will look very digital. And when you project it as well, if you don't have projectors that run a high, you know, contrast and resolution to, and filtering as well. You know, if you want it to look like film, you'd need that kind of organic grain look that digital doesn't have. It's very easy to just make the experience a lot less magical.
I definitely noticed that with the Hobbit films because they were doing things that technically...
Oh, they were 48 as well.
So the cinema I saw, well, at least the first one in, it was an awful experience because they just didn't have the setup for it.
Yeah.
And I think that's the case with a lot of movies. Also noticed that with Hateful Eight, I was hearing some people going to certain cinemas that just, these cinemas were so new, they had never projected anything on film before.
Oh, yeah.
And then they were trying to do that, and it was a disaster. So I had to sort of shop around a bit before I actually saw Hateful Eight on film.
That's so sad.
Yeah, it's strange that we've forgotten this so quickly.
It's very sad because, like I said, I love digital and I believe digital is fully capable of emulating the style in projection and recording that film can do, but we just haven't really tapped into the art of adjusting it appropriately. Okay, so back to Prometheus. I just wanted to say film. I watched it in film. It was the last movie I have seen, I think. That was 2012, so it's been about 6 years almost.
Yeah.
I think, yeah.
Yep.
And that makes me sad because I miss film, because I never thought I would say that, because as I mentioned before, I like digital and I believe digital projection can match film. There's a feeling in film that when you look into the screen, it feels like you're being put into that cinematic world because of that very high contrast, but you can still, that organic feeling that you can still see in those dark shades of shadow, because you really can in a cinema when it's projecting film that digital still can't do. And so I watched the film. Good, we're here. I watched the film. I finished it. I sort of enjoyed it. And what I took away from it was that I really loved the concepts. I really loved the ideas in them. I really liked the whole story as far as how the events transpire, but the ending in particular left a lot to be desired, but not because of it not answering any questions. I don't know why people have this asphyxiation to know everything. Why do you have to know everything? That's one of the weird things about moviegoers.
Yeah, I actually think that's the genius of Prometheus, is that they managed to open up the world in a way that had never been done before, and it answers some questions, but in doing so, raises so many more.
Yeah.
And I think that's the best case scenario for a film franchise like this, where you could never satisfy a whole audience where the characters essentially meet God and you essentially get the answer as to what the space jockey is. You know, that they left enough ambiguity there, and I think that's quite respectable.
Yeah, and we are landed in this minute. Oh, my segue is perfect.
Yes.
We're landed in this minute to see them actually lifting the helmet to reveal this human face, human-like face. And this is one of the engineers. And only, like, if you haven't talked about this before, we can talk about the controversy of the existence of the fact that the elephantine trunk and skeletal body shape of the space jockey from Alien 1 is now revealed to just be an exoskeletal biomechanical set of armor or like a spacesuit.
Yeah, I've touched upon it here and there, but yeah, we can definitely go into it more. I think it's quite appropriate for this minute. People really fixated on, no, the space jockey is this, because the comics definitely play a big part that...
Yeah, in the comics, I was gonna mention that.
For decades, people really... Well, I mean, they still do it to this day, that they take all that expanded universe stuff as canon and as lore, and I never do. I just sort of think of it as kind of a fun what if.
Yeah. For me, what is canon and what's not canon is a little bit of a exalted too much, because we are watching fiction, and I'm not saying you can put whatever you want into it that can be, you know, that will be canon to you, but actually I might be saying that as well. I don't know how I'm describing this properly, but I do say that for me, like, when I watch Star Wars, for example, people talk about the expanded universe and how that was axed by the new Disney continuity and stuff like that. I feel like it's still there. You know, you can still read it, you can still listen to it, you can still watch, or you can still play the games. And I don't know what's so wrong about you just saying, no, this is how I like the story. You know, I have Dash Rendar. There's Kyle Katarn in my, that you would say, headcanon. And I think it's fun to discuss that then.
Yeah.
Like, for me, I am more of a original trilogy Star Wars guy, and I can easily watch those three films without thinking of, you were the chosen one! And, you know.
It's over, I have the high ground.
You underestimate my power.
Oh my god, that was too spot on. I think it all ties back to, yeah, Star Wars and Alien and all of these franchises, I think it all ties back into that fan ownership, where fans believe, no, I have the correct vision of this story. Like, I'm the keeper of the continuity. Right. And, I mean, there's some toxic elements there, but I think we're at a phase now. It's been interesting to watch this evolve, where these films, you know, there was only 2, 3, 5, 6 at most, and they didn't come out that often. And that was it. That's all you had. And there wasn't the internet, and there might be some comics and stuff. But I think over the years, and especially more recently, I think we're in a time of nostalgia where we're getting a lot of franchises that are reboots and sequels, and you've got these ongoing stories. And in response, you're getting a particular kind of fan. And I see that a lot in the Alien community, that we're kind of divided in the original two films, or even there are some people who go, no, I won't even accept James Cameron's editions. It's just Ridley Scott and nothing else.
Yeah.
Or they say, not the first Alien.
Yeah, Tim, our cousin, mine and Jacob's cousin from the Matrix Minute, Tim, he's one of our co-hosts for the Matrix Minute, and that's his belief as well. He's just Ridley Scott Alien 1, that's it.
Yeah, I guess they're the purest of the pure, where other people, they're trying to piece together everything. And you've got a lot of YouTube channels where people are trying to go, well, okay, so this comic happened here, and then in this movie this happened. It's just like, buddy, it wasn't meant to tie together.
It wasn't, but it is fun. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's what is kind of an issue. I don't know why you would take it so, maybe not personally, but I mean, like, you're taking it a little bit too far. Like, you can't be angry at it. Maybe you can. See, it's complicated. It's really complicated.
Anger is a weird thing to have about fiction. But so I watched Solo recently.
Yeah.
And I went, oh, this is actually really undermining a lot of things that are crucial to this character. And that's where I didn't enjoy the film just because it was boring. But, you know, like the Solo surname.
Oh, yeah,
even...
That's silly.
Like, but when you play with those sorts of things, you sort of start to question, what do I consider real?
Yeah, it's true, but like, real. You know, as far as I'm concerned, I watched the film, I didn't like it very much, but it's I don't even think about it when I'm watching the originals or when I even, like, think of the originals.
That's probably the best attitude to have, that, it's a little exploration, it's a little tangent, or a what if, I think is the best way to see those sorts of things.
Yeah, and what's the harm, like, I know that Lucasfilm can do whatever they want with their ideas of the continuity, but what's the damage that it's going to do to the original films, you know, because the original films are on their own, they're there, they exist, unless they change them retroactively, which, you know, had a lot of that already.
Mm. Well, that's what we have here with Prometheus, and I think especially with Alien Covenant. A lot of people had a very visceral reaction to Covenant because they were just like, David didn't create the alien. How dare you? And I was like, no, that's fucking cool, man. Let's see where this goes. I'm on board. This is wacky. Holy shit.
Yeah, exactly. But David didn't create the alien. How dare you?
Get off my podcast.
Okay.
But yeah, so in this minute, we're seeing sort of the culmination of all those fan anxieties of, no, this is for, you know, for decades, you've imagined what this creature is. No.
And to be honest, dude, honestly, I did this too as a 15-year-old. I had huge ambitions. I still do, but I keep them to myself at the moment. And I wanted to make...
Yes, happens to everyone. Yes.
And I've always wanted to be making movies, and I still do, and all that kind of stuff. It's all fun.
I'm so glad you share your childhood filmography. It's just delightful.
Well, we have a huge catalog. It's ridiculous. Like, the movies that me and my brother made when we were younger is quite large, and I still defend them in terms of their, like, in their base form, in their conceptual form. I think you can still make some movies out of them just based on the ideas. You know what I mean? So
honestly, I feel like, I don't want to, you know, get distracted flattering you, but I love watching them because I go, it's so fledgling, but there's this raw talent and a raw passion there. And there's something about that I honestly really love. And when I'm watching these on Facebook, it's kind of hard to convey that, like, heart, there you go.
Aw, thank you. That makes me feel very happy because, you know, not many people have seen those because we don't put them online or anything. We just put a few of them. But I had ambitions.
I think it's a real shame people look back at the early stuff and just go, oh, no, it's embarrassing. Oh, throw it out. But I think there's real merit to sharing it.
Thank you. I'll try to be more brave next time. So anyway, I had this ambition to make the first alien movie, but for IMAX, and I wanted to make the IMAX Alien 3D film. So it was going to be, this is before the digital revolution, this was before people making 3D movies. So this was 2004, so I watched a few 3D IMAX films, you know, like the documentaries, like there's New York 3D, and then there was Space, something with the moon, and Tom Hanks narrating. That kind of thing. And I thought, we can use IMAX cameras and it's going to be 3D and we're going to make an alien movie because Alien's awesome. So I'm going to make an alien prequel. Now listen to this. 2004, I'm like, I'm making an alien prequel. It's going to be like, you know, 40 minutes long because IMAX cameras are big and huge and, you know, the films are big and large. And I was taking that into account back when, you know, before digital. It was going to be a standalone story where there was this colony in space drifting in a kind of space station. And mysteriously, oh, by the way, the main character was going to be played by Jean Reno.
Okay.
And and he's just a kind of sheriff character, like just like a security guard keeping track of his sector in this space colony. And mysteriously, when there are these kids playing around in the pipes, they find an egg. And you know what happens, right?
Yeah.
The whole alien thing happens. But in the end, Jean Reno, the character, finds out that these eggs have been planted, and then he you know, like goes through the security cameras or whatever, and he sees the ship and somehow tracks it, and so he goes back to the alien planet where that's where everybody wanted the whole thing to go, right? And then he sees the engineers, and then that kind of turns it into, like, and then he crash lands into LV-421. It's 421, right?
426, and then...
Yeah.
LV-426 is the one in Alien, and then 223, yeah.
Oh, 426, there we go. Okay, and he just crash lands there, and he sends a warning message, and then it leads up to Alien. So that's what I wanted to do when I was 15. There we go. So we all thought he was the Elephant Man, but now he's this very, very human creature. And I have to say, I really like it. I like it.
I do too, because it's in that uncanny valley. I'm always going on about the uncanny valley. And when you see the...
But it's good!
Yeah, when you see the engineer standing next to a human, you go, oh, no, that's not human at all. Ooh.
Yeah, and I just love this engineer design, because the way their faces look, and I'm sure you mentioned this once or twice, is like the first thing that, you know, dropped into my mind was that it looks like those old Renaissance era Greek hero characters.
Yeah, you definitely got the ancient Greek influence. That was Ridley said, I want them to have this ancient Greek physique, and then you sort of got that upturned, or what do they call the Cupid's bow lips, and then the brow that just goes straight into the nose.
Yes.
They actually used Elvis Presley as inspiration as well.
Oh. And Michelangelo's David.
Definitely.
Because that's the thing that hit my... That's the first thing that came to mind when I saw this. I was like, but I think that's so perfect. I think that's so... I don't know why people don't like this. They say it's not very imaginative. And, you know, I love the elephant people as well. I really do. I think you could go both ways, in my opinion. Like, if it was the elephant guys, I would be loving that too, you know? But I think this hits home in a more creepy, like you say, uncanny valley.
Yeah, I think it's almost like a race memory. You know, when you see that face, you're, oh my God, we've been channeling this in our art for centuries.
Yes!
That's really
not
creepy.
It's not inherently ours, you know what I mean?
Mm.
It's from like a different planet, from like this civilization, this species, we have no idea what they're about.
And in execution, the makeup is incredible. I think if it hadn't been convincing enough, if it looked too Star Trek, it would have fallen apart. But they are genuinely beautiful.
Yeah, and I think that this sculpt over here, this animatronic head, is very good. I think this is one of the highlights in the film, for sure.
Yeah, this animatronic head, it was a practical effect, and it's incredible. It's by an artist called Gustav Hogan, and it's one of those things that a lot of people assumed was CGI. This movie got a lot of people complaining, oh, too much CGI, but they didn't actually use a lot of CGI in this movie. I'll put a video in the footnotes. Oh, man, the head moves in such... It's so real.
Yeah, I totally agree. I really, really like this scene. It's spooky, and it's wonderful.
I think, well, it was something I was going to say earlier, that love or hate this movie, there's so much to take away from it. You could never just dismiss Prometheus outright. And I think that's why there was so much discussion.
I agree.
And even now, every single minute, I got something to talk about.
That's why you did the podcast.
Yeah, because I was basically doing this almost in my sleep. Sometimes I would be lying in bed going, how would I do Prometheus by minute? Oh, yeah, and I could talk about this, and I could do that, and now I'm doing it for real.
Oh, yeah.
So on this scene in particular, I've got some notes. The design of the lab was inspired by the one in the Nostromo with the cantilevered examination table. It's a very unusual design, which is kind of retro, but futuristic, which, I mean, this movie, aesthetic.
Yeah.
So Vickers walks in and cuts straight to the chase.
So are they all dead?
What? Who?
Your engineers. Are they all dead or aren't they?
I don't know. We just got here.
Do you even care if they're all dead?
Waylon cared.
I do love this sort of dynamic between Vickers and Elizabeth, the true believer, and then just the most bitter bitch you've ever met.
Yeah.
And, oh, as she walks in, I like David's micro expression. So he's, you know, focusing on the work and then senses that Vickers enters the room. And he sort of goes, does that, you know, he's like, what? Huh? Oh, you're here. But to me, I mean, I am focusing very closely on it, but I really feel like it's so programmed. It's a programmer going, oh, well, he can't just sit up and look at whoever is entering the room before they enter the room. They've programmed this sort of distracted subroutine.
I noticed that David does do a lot of, oops, sorry, which is interesting.
Yeah. So that, I don't mean to be an inconvenience. I go on about Fassbender's performance a lot, but there really is so much attention to detail. You don't get that with a lot of, I don't know if it's necessarily actors or if it's just very few characters give you this much of a sandbox to play in.
Mm-hmm. Much of the movie has to do with creating life, and David is artificial life, and so he's quite important in the theme of this film. And I think that Michael Fassbender and Ridley Scott as well, I think they both really wanted to delve into what makes AI and intelligence, you know, what makes him alive.
That really has become the central thesis of these movies, and that's why Alien Covenant blew my mind, because it's just like, oh, I see where this is all going now. And watching Prometheus with that added context, I'm really focusing on David and realizing, oh, and this will come up in one of your later minutes, that this story is about David, and all the big character beats are actually these little minor background ones.
Well, I'm quite intrigued with the next minutes.
Yeah, so if we'll get to that soon. So, Shaw says, do you even care if they're dead, to Vickers, and then Vickers just says Wayland cared. I think the dialogue in this film is quite efficient. I think Ridley's all about efficiency, and you know, when you watch a movie a few times, you realize, oh, these characters aren't even in sharing that many scenes, but there's a lot of weight in that dialogue, I think. Meredith really stands out in this scene, and as is the case in previous minutes, I think that's primarily due to the costume and the posture that costume brings with it. You know, she's so shark-like, and that comes into full effect in this scene because the rest of the crew are wearing scrubs, so by nature, that just makes everyone sort of blend into the background because, well, we've seen that uniform in real life, and it's not a very attractive one. I think it's the color as well. The blue seems to fade into the background, and yet, you know, you don't tend to think of gray as being a bold choice, but for some reason it really works here, and I think that might be lighting, and as a costume person, I find that so fascinating that she's in shadow, whereas the rest of the scene's, you know, very harshly lit, and yet that makes her stand out rather than be less obvious.
Well, yeah, it might be the texture of the material. It's a little reflective.
It's very true. That's in an early minute, I talked about how it's like the most rare, expensive wool on the face of the earth. So
really?
Maybe that's why they chose it. Yeah.
Ooh.
It's made from this wool that comes from a particular kind of alpaca that only lives in a very remote hill. And whoa, you can only collect the wool once a year, and they can't be bred in captivity because they get too stressed out and they starve themselves to death.
What?
So, yeah, and the wool is like, oh, so many microns across. Like, it's 1/10 of a human hair thickness. And a meter of it, or like a square meter, is about $1,000 US.
Duh.
If I recall correctly. So, you would hope that it did something magical on screen, and I guess this scene finally proves it.
It seems like it. Man, I don't even want to think of how much the jacket, the uniform costs.
Yeah, the entire thing. I think I did a breakdown in that episode, it's insane. And I would just be terrified to cut it. Mm-hmm. Whoever cut it must have been... I think I did actually look into it, and that person was just super, super qualified and one of the best in the business. But yeah, oh.
Or they just didn't tell that person what it was.
Yeah, oh, that would be too... I would hire the best, you know, Seville Row cutter and just not tell them how much that fabric costs, because it's just too stressful, man. Strangely enough, Vickers actually even out-robots David in this minute. Because David... I think David's sort of, you know, he's sitting down, he's got the scrubs on, where she just... full T-1000 mode.
Yeah. You've definitely heard some of the theories that... Is Vickers maybe also an android?
I'm okay with it being either or both. Like, maybe there was a Vickers and maybe there was a David Wayland, who was Wayland's son. Like, any of that sort of speculation, I love it. I welcome it. I'm not picky. I just sort of love thinking about the possibilities.
I know. That's what this movie is very good at, because of all the open-ended thread lines.
Yeah, you can just have that, I don't know, headcanon, or you can let your imagination go wild and go, is David based on someone? Is Meredith human? Is she based on someone? That all of that, I love it. I think the Wayland family is of great interest to me.
Yeah. How does this connect with Bishop? never mind.
Well, yeah. Continuity's shifted around something, because there's Charles Bishop Wayland, and then there's the Wayland robot clone.
Yeah.
This is not the Alien 3 minute, so these are answers I do not have for you.
Yeah. Fair enough.
In the background, we have Holloway popping into the scene. He hops up onto the counter and takes a swig of a bottle.
That's right, he does.
Yeah, this is meant to signal that he has started his alcoholic sulk session. What a professional.
This is correct. I can recall this quite well.
Like, I will get into it in later minutes when it becomes more relevant, but what are you doing, Holloway? Come on.
Seriously. And they have a limited supply of this stuff, too.
That's very true. Gotta be careful, man.
I just noticed, did you see behind Vickers, there's like these jars that are just bubbling around. They look like potions.
Oh, I did not. I'm going to get back 47 point.
Little bubbling jars.
What be those? I had not noticed that before.
They're clearly mana and health potions.
Ah, we've got white and sort of a chartreuse color. That was their next course of action, to bring the engineer back to life, maybe? When science fails, alchemy is clearly...
Yes! Perfect. See? There we go.
So, my final note for this minute is... And I really love this as well. Another David moment. He's not my boyfriend. Shut up. Is he takes one quick look at the helmet, and he just instantly figures out how it opens up. You know, he doesn't fumble. He's not... You know, humans, obviously, we would sort of feel and try and figure out the best way to do it. But the way he's just so effortless, it indicates to me that he's actually running a lot of calculations or simulations about his actions before he enacts them.
Yeah, I was just about to say, like, once you mentioned that, and then me remembering things about David in this film, where, you know, computers, when they have to evaluate and calculate things, and maybe also learn when they can... For us, it's very linear. We always have to be like, okay, there's this, this, and that, and then there's muscle memory. But for someone like David, who's definitely has artificial programming and these systematics to help him work things out, learning to like take out the helmet, you know, just by giving it a good look and then opening one of the levers, I guess you could say, on the helmet, probably like makes him able to calculate these things very, very, very fast. And it's not linear like for us, where we have to be like, oh, okay, this is this and this is that. And, you know, for him, it's just he can, you know, bring back all kinds of knowledge that he stored and utilize it. very efficiently.
Yeah. That reminds me, in real life, they have these, that they make AI do all these simulations. Like, one was made to learn how to play Super Mario. You know, had no idea, you know, didn't know anything about, it didn't have any preconceived notions of reality. You know, when a human being picks up a game, mm-hmm. we sort of understand left to right, up and down, all those sorts of, we've got an idea of, oh, this is a humanoid figure moving through a two-dimensional, one-dimensional space.
Yep.
And this AI knew nothing. It had tabula rasa, if you will.
Ah.
And so it basically, through simulation over and over and over again, just figured out, okay, no, we're not moving left, we're moving right. Okay, you avoid this. And it's fascinating, watch it run millions of simulations.
Yeah, yeah.
The other one was they taught it to walk. So basically it was given this stick figure, the basic configuration of legs, didn't have any other instructions beyond that. It just had to figure out how to, figure out locomotion, just how do we ambulate from one point to the other. And again, just ran through countless simulations until it got it right. That's amazing.
And then once you, you know, like as an artificial person, once you learn that, you have it in your memory forever, and you can always bring that solution to other things that you have to learn. So it goes faster and faster and faster, the amount of things that you can learn as not being a human.
I think that's why androids are more fascinating to me than just an AI without a body. I mean, first of all, they're characters that can kind of interact with their environment. But, well, even when it comes to the idea of real androids or robots, they are having to deal with reality, with gravity, with the forces of nature, but it has this seemingly endless intelligence. That's fascinating,
yeah,
to me.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Actually, just today I was going for a walk in the park. I'd never gone this way before. There's a really steep hill. And I thought, I actually don't know. Like, it was mostly soil. And I went, oh, I don't know if I'm actually going to walk down this properly, or am I just going to tumble? And I had that thought of, well, if I were an AI, I'd map the terrain in real time and figure out if I could walk down there or not. Humans, we're just falling over A over T all the time because we have to do it in real life.
Yes. Absolutely.
So what I'm trying to say is, if David were real, mostly I'd want to try and see if I can push him over like one of those Boston Dynamics androids or robots.
Oh, man. Yeah. Those poor Boston Dynamics robots.
It's for science. I'm sure they give them, you know, pats and hugs and all that afterwards.
Hopefully. You never know.
Did you have anything else for this minute?
Well, I don't know. Just the... We'll talk about that next time, since this episode's been going quite a while, especially considering I just was talking about how I started, you know, how I watched Prometheus and what I thought of it. So we can do this next time.
Yes. All right. That about covers it. This is Coulson signing off. Did you want to do a sign off too?
This is Phil, last survivor of this. No, I'm not. Not this podcast. That's no.
Oh no, what are you implying?
No. Signing off.
Yeah, there we go. You can find... Okay. You can find me on traviandesigns.com, TRAVIAN, or Prometheus by Minute on Facebook.